This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I had the craziest dream last night about a girl who was turned into a swan. But her prince falls for the wrong girl, and she kills herself.
That's my guest, Natalie Portman, playing a ballerina in the new psychological thriller, Black Swan. Portman's character dances in a New York City ballet company that is about to do its annual performance of Swan Lake. She gets the lead, playing the dual role of the innocent white swan and the seductive and evil black swan. Because this dancer is inhibited and sheltered, it's difficult for her to convincingly play the black swan. In the process of preparing for the role, she goes deep into her dark side and confuses both herself and the film's audience about where reality ends and paranoid fantasy begins. The film was directed by Darren Aronofsky, who also directed The Wrestler. Both films are in part about people who push their bodies to physical extremes. Natalie Portman made her film debut at the age of 12 in the 1994 film The Professional. Her other movies include Beautiful Girls, Anywhere But Here, Garden State, The Other Boleyn Girl, and the three Star Wars prequels. Natalie Portman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So what was the preparation like for you to try to develop a ballerina's body and movement?
I started training a year ahead of time with a great teacher, Mary Helen Bowers, who was in the New York City Ballet for 10 years. She started very basic with me, really focusing on strengthening my toes. We would do 15 minutes of just toe exercises a day to get ready for going on point, plus obviously ballet. And then we upped it to, you know, we added more time as we went along, more hours a day of ballet, and we added swimming. We swam a mile a day. We toned. I watched the Frederick Wiseman documentaries on ABT and Paris Opera Ballet, which were really helpful, and read a lot of autobiographies of dancers. I tried to do mainly New York City ballet dancers because I thought it was important to locate it in a particular culture, to have a sort of specific world, because every company is very different. So it was sort of Balanchine era New York City ballet that gave me the background.
Are there things you have to do in ballet that you had to learn how to do that a human body would otherwise never do?
Absolutely. The turnout is extreme and, you know, something that is not natural for a lot of bodies. I think because I had the dance training when I was little, it wasn't impossible for me to have turnout starting at 27.
Describe what turnout is.
Turnout is having your sort of from your hips to your toes pointing outwards instead of being parallel to each other. And, you know, everything is supposed to be turned out, every move, every you know, tendu or grand battement, you need to be turned out. You have to sort of tuck your butt underneath and like pull in your stomach towards your back so that your back becomes flat and doesn't have an arch, which is not very natural for the spine. And of course, going on point is also very unusual. it's not a natural way for your body to hold itself.
Did you have to do on point for Black Swan?
Yes. I was on point there's no way, obviously, I could have learned, you know, fouetté turns on point for the film. That's something that takes a lifetime to perfect. So there's a wonderful dancer, Sarah Lane, who did the more complicated point work. But I did the stuff that was possible to learn in a year.
So what happened to your feet in the process?
They get disgusting. The toenails fall off. They get blistered and calloused, and you don't want anyone to look at them and certainly not touch them.
And what about the rest of your body? I read you dislocated a rib. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that was the sort of worst injury I had, was a dislocated rib, which basically we just dealt with by not
Not breathing.
Yeah, exactly. No deep breaths for 6 weeks, and I didn't get lifted from my rib cage anymore. I got lifted under my armpits because that's sort of what does it. Yeah, but it wasn't the end of the world. You know, real dancers dance with such incredible injuries that you wouldn't even believe. You know, it's such a nightmare for them to be replaced. You know, once they've made it to the top and they get these great roles, they will dance on a sprained ankle or torn plantar fascia, twisted necks, you know, just to make sure that they can keep their moment.
There are some very gruesome, disturbing body images in the film. Maybe gruesome isn't exactly the right word, almost surreal. Like, mm-hmm. There's an image where your toes are completely stuck together. It's almost as if they'd grown into each other. And you're, like, trying to, like, pry them apart. And then there's an image of you peeling skin off your hand. You know, it's as if it's dry skin and you're peeling it off and, like, a whole bunch of skin comes off. And then you have this rash on your back, or never really sure what caused that, yes. or what it is. And it keeps getting bigger and uglier. You crack your feet and you crack your toes. And like, some of this reminded me of the kind of like body imagery you're likely to get in a surreal dream.
Right. Absolutely. Darren Aronofsky, our director, who's clearly unbelievable. He is so good at physicalizing anxiety and terror and obsession. And that's so much of it for dancers. I mean, it's all about the way your body looks and the way your body moves. And when your worst anxiety and your worst terror is that you're going to be prevented from moving, or, you know, that your toes would stick together, or that you know, that your skin wouldn't be pale enough, or your body wouldn't be thin enough. I mean, these are real ideals that people talk about. And obviously any blemishes would be the worst nightmare to cover.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Natalie Portman, and she's starring in the new movie Black Swan, and she plays a ballet dancer in it. When you accepted the part in Black Swan, and you were working with, you know, professional ballet choreographers and trainers, were people sizing you up and thinking, like, it's going to be tough? You know, she doesn't really have a ballet dancer's body, and we're going to have to stretch this and change that and move this. And was that a weird process, having people assess you and finding you, like, wanting and then figuring out how to fix you?
It was. And, you know, it's also, you have physical limitations. You know, I'm short and I have short limbs. And, you know, the Balanchine sort of city ballet ideal is to be very long. And they had me working with a physical therapist / gyrotonics teacher, Michelle Rodriguez, who's fantastic, who works with all the dancers in New York, to lengthen me. And she was literally just pulling my arms and opening my back and, you know, having me over a ball. I would be lying on this sort of small ball, and she would just open my shoulders and open my back and do arm exercises to try and slim my arms and lengthen them. I was given instructions to lose as much weight as I could without getting sick, and, you know, was told every day sort of by the coaches and stuff that I wasn't looking like a ballerina yet. And all of a sudden, when I really started dieting and lost a serious amount of weight, all of a sudden I started getting compliments from everyone. But it was very much like what that world is.
Now, Mila Kunis co-stars, and mm-hmm. she plays a new dancer in the company. And the ballet master thinks that she's very good, and in fact she becomes your understudy. And mm-hmm. It's always hard to tell whether she's trying to be your best friend or trying to totally undermine you so that she can take over as the lead. And this is where the thriller aspect of the
right.
of the movie comes in. Now, I read, and tell me if this is true, that the director of the film, Darren Aronofsky, actually created a backstage competition between the two of you, that he would tell you that she was doing better than you were in terms of really getting the ballet moves down, and then he'd tell her that you were doing better than she was.
Exactly.
So did he actually do that?
Yeah, it was really funny because Mila and I have been friends for years. And when we were, Darren and I have been talking about the film for 10 years. And finally, when it started rolling a year ahead of time, he said, you know, do you have any ideas for who could play Lily? And I was at the flea market with Mila and I was telling her that I was doing the ballet training. And she's like, oh, be careful. I broke all of my toes doing ballet. And so I called up Darren and I was like, Mila dances, Mila dances. So then, you know, he met her and cast her, which was really exciting to work with a friend. But then I was like, why can't we train together? You know, we're doing the same thing. Can't we take class? He kept us completely separate. He tried to make us like not see each other. And then he would tell me things like, Mila's looking really good. And then he would tell her like, oh, Natalie's so much better than you. And we would talk. So we knew that he was totally just messing with us. And we would just laugh because, you know, we'd go out for our salad or whatever we were eating at the time and, you know, dish on what kind of feedback he was giving each of us. So we didn't really let him manipulate us as he desired.
Now, you had your first film role when you were 13?
I was 11, actually. I turned 12 while we were filming The Professional, yes. Very young.
And what a role to have at such a young age, because you play a girl whose family is murdered. So you kind of move in with and apprentice yourself to a hitman. And you want to learn the trade so you can get revenge against the person who killed your family, particularly your brother. And then you think you're falling in love with him. And, of course, he's this middle-aged hitman, and you're 12 in the movie. So right. How did you get that part?
Well, I had sort of begged my parents to audition for things. We lived on Long Island where a lot of sort of kids I knew were going out on auditions for Broadway shows or commercials, and my parents weren't really that keen on it, but saw it as my passion and supported it. And then that was just the first thing I got, which probably attests to the kind of kid I was, that I wasn't getting like Rice Krispies commercials, which I would have died for, but that they cast me in this kind of crazy French film.
What does that say about what you were like as a kid?
I think I was, you know, acting like a grown-up, even though I certainly didn't have the maturity of one, but I knew how to mimic a grown-up pretty well. So I think the sort of cute kid roles just never were the things that anyone was interested in me for, whereas, you know, the child woman was sort of my type.
Now, your father is Israeli, your mother American. You were born in Jerusalem. At the age of 3, the family moved to the U.S. How much time have you spent in Israel since moving to the U.S.?
A lot. I go back at least once a year, but usually 2-3 times a year. And 5 years ago, I did a semester of grad school at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. So I lived in Jerusalem for like 6 months.
Do you find that your personality changes a little bit in Israel compared to when you're in the States?
I don't know about my personality. Probably my politics. You know, it's like how you can like say bad things about your parents to like your brother or sister, but you wouldn't say it to like, you know, just a friend. It's sort of like you can criticize the government more when you're in the country among other Israelis than outside. It sort of feels like you're betraying your family or something.
So you're more critical of Israeli policy when you're there than you are when you're
here? Yeah. Well, I think you just feel more at ease to talk about it because you're talking to other people who are in the same boat as you, you know, as opposed to being like, oh, someone here is going to take my opinion as an Israeli and make it represent my entire country, you know?
How politically involved have you gotten in Middle East politics?
Not, you know, I think I was really, really involved when I was probably in my early 20s. I was, you know, reading Haaretz every day. It was like the page, the website I opened to on my computer. I would read obsessively and was very passionate and very emotionally roused by it. And then I just sort of had to disconnect, and I barely pay attention anymore because I think it's just I know it's not necessarily the proudest thing you can say, because I know it's important to be engaged, but it's just – it can get so hard to feel that emotional about something that you have no impact on, you know, for such a long time.
One set of your grandparents – stop me if I'm wrong here. One set of your grandparents was killed in Auschwitz?
No. My great-grandparents.
Great-grandparents.
Okay. Yes. My father's parents migrated to Israel before the war in the late 30s. So their parents were killed in the camps.
How was the Holocaust first described to you? Do you remember?
I don't remember the first description. I just remember it being a prominent feature of my education because I went to a Jewish school. I went to Jewish day school until I was 13. So
in the United States?
Yeah, in the U.S. I went because we moved a lot when we were in the States. So I went to different schools in Maryland and then Connecticut and then Long Island. So it was just such a central part of our learning, of everything we learned, which, you know, definitely has its you can understand the power of memory for the Jewish people. But also there's the drawbacks too, because no one mentioned Rwanda to us, which was happening at the same time, which is kind of an interesting thing, which I regret and I you know, wish was different.
Were you religious when you were going to Jewish school or?
Oh, no. No, my family, like most Israelis, are very, very non-religious. My dad wanted me to keep my Hebrew, and because it was half a day in Hebrew, that sort of was the purpose. And so they would, you know, tell me to sort of abstain from prayer in the morning, and because we had to pray every morning, and we had to bring kosher lunch, and my mom would pack me like chicken salad sandwiches and tell me to lie and say it was tuna. And that's like part of why I became vegetarian, because I hated lying so much. It was like everyone was like, it doesn't smell like tuna. Yeah, then I was like, you're just sending me vegetarian lunches from now on.
Why was chicken bad?
Because it was only dairy at school.
Oh,
because,
I see.
You know, with milk and meat, it was only a dairy kitchen, so you could only bring dairy lunches. So if she would pack me meat, she would make me say it was like something else.
Did you wish you were going to a public school at that time?
Oh, yeah. And I finally convinced my parents to let me switch in eighth grade, mainly because I think it was just really small. There were only 20 kids in my class. And I switched to a public school where there are 500 kids in my class. And that made me really happy.
Now, a lot of actors drop out of school so that they could just act, you know, in a TV series or in a movie, or they just study acting. I mean, they major in acting in college, whereas you studied at Harvard and majored in psychology while continuing your acting career. And then you spent a semester, I think, at the University of Jerusalem. But from what I read, it sounds like you didn't study acting. You studied other things.
Yeah, well, I've been acting since I was 11, in, you know, film and stage, and I've gotten to have so many amazing experiences and work with so many people that it's been sort of a school for me. And so having the opportunity to go to university, which is really such luck. I mean, how many people in the world, especially how many women in the world, get to have higher education? It's really so rare that I just wanted to take advantage of you know, everything I could. And psychology seemed also a way where I could learn things that would be eventually helpful to my acting career without, you know, actually taking acting classes there.
And was it helpful?
Absolutely. I mean, for this part, you know, just reading the script and immediately having insight into obsessive compulsive behavior and ritualistic, almost religious practices, the relationship with a mother that is, you know, restrictive and suffocating, and this desire to please, the ability to dissociate oneself when you're seeing yourself through other people's eyes, you know, because she's always viewing herself through her mother's eyes, her director's eyes, her audience's eyes. The character, you know, starts seeing herself out of her body, and that has to do with the dissociation where she starts seeing this double. So it was really it was really helpful for this role, and has been helpful for roles in the past.
Natalie Portman, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you so much for having me on.
Natalie Portman stars as a ballerina in the new movie Black Swan. We'll talk with her co-star, Vincent Cassell, in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, the French actor Vincent Cassell, plays the demanding artistic director of a ballet company in the new film Black Swan. Earlier this year, his film Mesrine was released in the U.S., in which he portrayed the famous French gangster Jacques Mesrine. Reviewing it in the New York Times, Stephen Holden wrote, "Cassell's monumental performance fuses the cobra-like menace of the young Robert Mitchum with the shape-shifting volatility of the classic Robert De Niro." Cassell played the son of a Russian gangster in David Cronenberg's film Eastern Promises and just finished shooting a new Cronenberg film. He played a master thief in Ocean's 12. His father, the late actor Jean-Pierre Cassell, worked with several French New Wave directors. Here's Vincent Cassell in a scene from Black Swan. He's working with the talented but inhibited dancer, played by Natalie Portman, who he's chosen to star in Swan Lake. He's trying to convince her to let go.
In 4 years, every time you dance, I see you obsessed, getting each and every move perfectly right, but I never see you lose yourself. Ever. All that discipline for what?
Just want to be perfect.
You what?
Want to be perfect.
Perfection is not just about control. It's also about letting go. Surprise yourself so you can surprise the audience. Transcendence. And very few have it in them.
I think I do have it in.
Ah! You bit me? I can't believe you bit me.
I'm sorry.
Vincent Cassell, welcome to Fresh Air. So what we just heard was Natalie Portman biting you. After you've kissed her, was that in the script? Were you expecting that to happen?
No, it was. Of course, it was written. We did it many times, actually.
Oh, that must have felt good.
Well, she didn't really bit me. I think she did it the first time, and then it wasn't really needed anymore. So, you know, it's just acting, let's say.
Right. Well, that's the thing. You say it's just acting, but for her, like, she had to go through those like grueling regimen of ballet training. Which you were probably spared from for the film, right?
Well, you see, I think in a career, once in a while, you get, you know, a part like that where you really have to get involved physically. It doesn't really have to do with, you know, the situation or the acting itself, but it's just like, let's say, a technical aspect that you need to go through, you know. For this time, I mean, with her, it was about dancing. Sometimes, you know, not so long ago, I had to gain a lot of weight. You know, it's things that you have to do. It's physically very demanding. But, you know, when it's such a wonderful part, I guess you just do it with a smile, you know. And that's what she did. She went for it, smiling.
Did you have to learn about dance for your part as the ballet master?
Actually, I've danced for a long time. I started my career as a dancer. My father was a dancer, so I literally grew up on sets, backstage, on stage, you know. And you know, so I really grew up in that environment. And I've danced. I took ballet classes for 7 years in Paris and in New York. So I really know what it was about. I remember the smell of the studio in the morning. And I still had my tights and all my, you know, my things. So, you know, I went back to the classes a little bit for that movie because I wanted to carry myself in a proper way. It still hurt a lot, you know.
Right. So what kind of dance did your father do and what kind of dance did you do besides ballet?
My father was a tap dancer, really, you know. he was part of Chorus Line in the London production. He was doing the part of Zach, who was actually more or less the same kind of character that I'm portraying in Black Swan. You know, he's a demanding director, let's say. And for myself, I did ballet and I did jazz, I did tap. And then capoeira, which is kind of a martial art, but it's still a dance. You know, nothing really well, but a little bit of everything.
I think one of the American films that you're best known for is Ocean's 12, just because that series is so popular. So I thought I'd play a scene from that so people can hear you in action, because playing the French movies wouldn't...
Nobody will get it.
Wouldn't quite work, yes. So you play a master thief, and and you see yourself as in competition with Danny Ocean, the George Clooney character, for who's the best thief. So let's hear a scene. You've invited Danny Ocean, George Clooney, to visit you at your mansion, where you end up making him a proposition.
Mr. Ocean,
you broke rule number one, and that has consequences.
Oh, you must be talking about the paintings. Don't worry. You'll be dead in 5 days and I'll get my paintings back.
Unless you have an accident first.
I don't think so, Daniel. Perhaps I should explain to you why I'm tormenting you like this.
I'd like that. Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, last month I was in Portugal to see my mentor.
A mark.
Indeed. A very loud and annoying American businessman was there the same day. He worked for a big insurance company. He's the one who suggested Benedict to you as a potential mark. You know the man?
What about him?
Well, he said it was the most beautiful job he'd ever seen, and he went on and on about this job, and then he said it showed you were the greatest thief in the world. But the worst part is that Lamarck never corrected him. I told Lamarck that you can't be better than me. And he answered that was impossible to know for sure. So, I thought about that for like 3 weeks in a row, day and night. And then suddenly I realized that he was actually right. It is impossible to compare one theft to the other. Huh? So, I guess the only way to know who's the best of us, for sure, is to go after the same object. Do the same job, don't you think? That would be fun.
You're being awfully cavalier with a lot of people's lives so you can play out a game. You're going to regret it.
That's George Clooney and my guest Vincent Cassell in a scene from Ocean's 12. Did this movie strike you as like a very American movie, because there's big American stars? It's a sequel to a film that was a remake of a Frank Sinatra film. The whole movie is tongue-in-cheek. So did it strike you as this, like, very American film?
Well, you know, not really, because when you look at it, okay, so you have a lot of big stars in it, but most of them are friends, you know? And Steven Soderbergh, the director, is definitely a very particular director in the American industry, I guess, you know, because he really managed to make those big movies, you know, like the Ocean's movies. And then on the other hand, he gets involved with subject matter like Solaris or, you know, really, really arty stuff. So it was a big movie, but it felt very homemade on set, you know, very homey, very warm, a bunch of guys who know each other for a while. And he had total control on it.
So the Ocean's films are, you know, very suave, and they're about, you know, they're about like style and charisma and everything. You played a genuine gangster in, I am used to saying Mazarin or Mazarin, okay. But that's not, you say it right for me.
It's actually, there's an S in the word, but...
He doesn't like that. The gangster doesn't like
no.
to say it.
But the real way to say it is Merine.
Merine.
Merine, yeah.
Okay. So you play, this is based on a real gangster who mm-hmm. lived in France, Jacques Mérine.
Jacques Mérine, in the 70s.
In the 70s, yes. So, and he was not very famous here. So tell us a little bit about the real gangster that your character is based on.
Well, the guy was very different from the rest of the gangsters we had in France, because he was the first one to use the media, really. You know, that's what really made the difference for him. He used the media for his own sake. He started what really happened is that he's been used as an icon of the counterpower by a left-wing press in those days. And I guess he really enjoyed it. And he had a huge ego. So he started to enjoy being in the papers and on TV and everything. So he started to, you know, call the journalist himself, and eventually managed to be on the front page of things like Paris Match, which is the equivalent more or less of Time Life magazine, you know. And so it's really his relation to the media that made him different. And actually, I think that's why he died, you know. He became much too noisy for the government at the time, and they just decided to get rid of him.
The movie is in two parts. Yeah. And in the second part, you're older and you're heavier, about 50 pounds heavier.
Something like that.
And you have like a big pot belly. Now, actors often like to get into character by putting on the character's clothes, putting on their hairdo or their hairpiece or whatever. But for this, it's like you're living in somebody else's body, and you're going to sleep in that body. You're going home in that body. It just must be so odd to totally transfigure yourself like that in a way that you can't take off when you go home at night.
Yes, it is very odd. It is very odd, and it's not something one should do too often, to be honest, because it's not good for you, obviously. But there's something really great about it, you know, just as we were saying for Natalie and Black Swan, you know, it's that when you get so physically involved with something, you don't have to do much after that, you know. I was breathing differently, you know, my walk was different, you know, so I felt so different already that it was kind of easy to imagine myself as somebody else, you know, and so that really helps. I think all these things you were just saying, you know, about, you know, hairdo and you know, all the clothes and everything are not something superficial. I think they are really important. If you let yourself go to the feeling that, you know, that you have wearing something that is not yours, you can go really far, actually.
Were you afraid that you'd never be yourself again physically?
Well, I have a tendency to think that you always change, really. So you're never really the one you were yesterday. And every movie, especially when you get involved with a movie, it takes something out of you. You know, you learn something, but you give something to the movie. And you, after a movie, if the experience has been intense and a true experience, you're a little different afterwards, you know, physically, you know. I've noticed that the first important movie that I did, I shaved my head for the movie. When the hair grew back, you know, I had white hair for the first time of my life. So it's you know, I have a tendency to play it cool and to say that it's, you know, easy and normal and it's no big deal. But I know it really takes something away from you when you get involved with something deeply.
What's another example of a role that changed you in some way that you had not expected it would?
It seems like, you know, when you do a character, especially when it's something that it's a little far away from you, it's like a door that you open. And when you're done with the movie, you open that door and it's there. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's kind of weird, but, you know, I played like a bunch of characters, and then I realized that I would go back to my normal me, you know, but in a way, there was something that I added to my personality, you know. For example, with Mesrine, you know, I realized that I feel heavier sometimes in the way I laugh, you know. Yeah, the laughs can really change, you know, with a character. You laugh in a certain way, and it's the way of the character, let's say, and then, you know, afterwards you realize that sometime in your laugh, there's something left from that character.
Now, your grandfather owned a movie theater, which was converted from a real theater, like a stage theater.
Yeah.
Would you describe the theater?
Okay. You see that big castle at the beginning of the Walt Disney movies?
Yes.
something like that.
No,
it's actually.
Really?
I swear. Yeah, yeah. It's actually. It was a casino. A casino. That. Well, it was a castle that Napoleon built back in the days for one of his lovers, and she never made it there. You know, she stopped because of the rain in Bordeaux. I think she stopped. And that thing became a casino with a theater, two nightclubs, and things like that. So, you know, I was literally with my brother and my cousins and all that. We were living in the dressing rooms of the theater, you know. So everybody had like a little room with a bed and a mirror with the lights around, you know, and and the bathroom. It was incredible. And the bathroom were actually the bathroom of the theater. So I would just open a door and be in the theater. So, you know, it was like a home cinema before it even existed, you know. And that's where I really discovered a lot of movies, you know, really good ones, very bad ones, horror films, cartoons, porn, anything, you know.
Porn? Did he show porn?
Yeah, at midnight on Saturdays.
Oh. So did,
imagine,
did your parents try to prevent you from seeing it or...
Well, my parents weren't really there, you know. It was more my grandparents. They were really busy, and anyway, you know, I knew the theater better than anybody else. So there was always a way to sneak in.
So were you surprised by pornography, or did you already know how it was
done?
No,
I knew, and I mean, you know, I mean, and imagine, I mean, I was 13. I was, you know, I loved it.
Now you spent some time in a circus school.
Yeah, quite a while, actually.
How much?
Like 5 years.
How come?
Well, my father didn't really want me to be an actor because he thought and he was right, actually. He kind of protected me from, you know, going in the same direction than him, you know, because you know, being an actor is wonderful when you got work, but when you don't, it's terrible. It's the end of the world. You don't do anything. So, I guess he just, you know... If I wanted to do it, it had to be very personal. And that's what it became, you know, very personal. But before I could go on stage and take acting class and stuff, you know, he didn't want me to get involved with that. So my way in was the circus, really, you know, because it was kind of like a stage. And I thought that actors should be able to do everything, you know. So... At the circus, you learn how to play with things, you know, you juggle, you need to work on your balance, you kind of work with your body, you know, and I don't know, I thought that was a plus for me, you know, so I got involved, and I've learned quite a lot of things, and especially to move, because, you know, I realized that a lot of actors don't know how to move their body, you know, they're stiff, at least in France. And so I've learned how to control my tool, really. And then, you know, I realized that it was all about the emotions. So I've learned how to control my emotions. But I started by the body.
So with the body, when you were in circus school, you learned how to juggle. What other like technical things did you learn?
Acrobatics. My specialty with acrobatics. So acrobatics, working on a wire.
Wow, you did that?
Yeah. Well, you kind of learn everything, you know, at first, and then you specialize in something. So trapeze, you know, acrobatics on a horse, and ballet. Because when you are at the circus school, you have to take ballet classes every day as a base, you know.
So when you were doing trapeze work, what was it like when you'd fall?
Well, there's a net.
I know there's a net, but still you're falling.
Well, it's actually, that's the first thing you learn, how to fall, you see, how to fall flat, because if you don't fall flat, you might hurt yourself. It's scary, you know, it's scary, it's exciting, it's, you have to abandon yourself, you know, and to abandon yourself is very useful when you act too, because you have to trust your choices, you have to trust, let's say, you have to trust yourself, really, you know, it's, and even though you're not always know where, how it's going to end, let's say. You know what, now that I'm talking about that with you, I realized that when I was much younger, I read a book by Stanislavski called...
The Actor Prepares?
Yeah, And he's talking about acrobatics. And that's, I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to get involved with the circus school too. And he was saying that when you start an acrobatic sequence, once you start it, you have to go to you have to do it until the end, because if you stop in the middle, you fall and you hurt yourself. And that's how you should start a scene too. You know, you have choices and you go for it. You don't know if you're gonna, you know, you're gonna fall or not, but you have to go with your choices until the end. You know, that idea of danger, you know. I think it's a good parallel between acting and acrobatic, you know. And that's one of the reasons why I want to get involved with that. You know, because when you act, sometimes you need to dare things, you know. You need to not be scared, even though you don't know what's going to happen.
My guest is Vincent Cassel. He co-stars in the new film Black Swan. He starred in the French gangster film Mesrine and played a master thief in Ocean's 12. So here's something I've been waiting to ask you. I know your parents divorced when you were 13. Your mother moved to America, and then you spent some time in America. And one of the things you did in America was go to summer camp. I'm dying to hear about that experience.
I've been twice to summer camps. I've been to Camp Redwood, upstate New York, and I've been to the camp called Blueberry Cove in the Maine. That was a real culture shock for me.
I was honestly thinking it might be.
No, because, you know, I mean, kids are not raised the same way in America and in France. There's a real difference, you know. And so it was pretty hard for me to get into it, you know. First of all, you have to do a lot of things when you're in camp. You have to play football. You have to to play basketball. You have to eat now. You know, it's like a lot of things. And I couldn't, you know, relate to that thing where you had to do things. I grew up, I didn't have to do anything, you know. I felt like a very free as a kid, you know. And suddenly, like, to have so many rules was kind of a tough thing. Actually, I ran away twice.
From camp, really? How did, did you have to run through the woods or something?
Yeah, I ran away, literally ran. I was, you know, and they catch me on the road running.
Just getting back for a second to the movie theater that you partially grew up in, what's one or two of the really good or really bad movies that you saw there that you think you may never have gotten to see had you not basically been living in a movie theater?
A lot of, you know, B-series from, you know, like the Insects of Fire, you know, for example. There was like roaches, you know, burning roaches that would like come off the phone and they would burn everything around, you know. They're really bad movies, but, you know, they were very scary at the time for me. And you know, the B series, I've seen a lot of those, and all those, like, there was like a trend in the 70s. They had like those kind of, it was like sexy movies, you know, from Italy with that actress called Edwige Fenech, was like a sex symbol. And so in one movie she was a nurse or she was a school teacher, you know. And those were really, really bad, really bad movies. And but I loved them because she was gorgeous, that actress.
So you loved acting when you were young and you love it now. Do you love it in a different way? Are there things about acting you love now that are really different from what you loved when you were young?
Well, you see, when I was really young, the problem is that I was acting, but in life, you know, I wouldn't call it lies, but let's say, you know, I don't know. I would create things. I would make people believe in things that wouldn't exist, you know, you know, I would like transform myself, you know, wearing disguise in the street in my neighborhood to see if people would recognize me or not, you know. So it's not very healthy after a certain point because you start to mix everything up. And but the interesting thing about it is that if you can make people believe things in life, then it's easy to make, you know, to make it in a movie, because it's harder, you know, to do that trick in life than on a set, you know. So when I started to work and get some job, you know, I started to express that on movies, in movies, and that was a relief, really, because I didn't have to do it in life anymore.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You took me so far away. I can't believe it.
Vincent Cassel plays the artistic director of a ballet company in the new film Black Swan. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.